providence that was exerted in giving us this book, this incredible book, your word to us, the precision that it gives us, the insight it gives us into your heart, to the beauties of your character, the wonders of your Trinity, and the glories of your Son, and sweetness of your Spirit. And we just pray that your word and your truth would create life and freedom in our lives today, in this hour that we spend, that indeed we would be free to see your Son for who he really is. And we just pray this for his glory, for his honor, and that we abandon ourselves into your hands, trusting and looking forward to your delight. We ask this for your Son's sake. Amen. Okay, now we are still caught in the universe. We're still stuck here. We are in the other syllabus. Someone called it a tome earlier, I noticed. Granted, I do tend to be verbose, but this is just a syllabus, not the actual writing. Consider yourself lucky in a Calvinist sense. Providence protected you, and is the other way to say that. So we are on page 6. We've been talking about, we're on the second of three bus tours. The first one was God. What was God like? We looked at the portrait of God. We tried to look at it from the standpoint of dancing theology, when theology goes dancing. We looked at it from that standpoint. Then we chugged into the universe, which was very small compared to God. And theoretically, it should take us less time to cover the universe than God, but we're not finding that to be the case. Okay? The universe has an ambiguous character about it, strangely enough, and so we have to plumb a little more deeply in some cases. We've been, so far in the universe, we talked about that it was derivative and it was created out of nothing. We actually had a little practice exercise, remember, where we were going to speak a universe into existence in our little hands, and we tried to do that by sheer force of will. We didn't get very far. I saw some attempts. There were some dust particles floating around in the back. So some of you have stronger willpower than others. The rest of us are still in 12-step programs working on this. Okay. Created by deliberate acts of speech, God spoke the universe into existence. It has a semantic character. Our lives might be called narratives, almost. We are almost like characters in a book. C.S. Lewis talked about how this is what it looks like. If I were Hamlet and I was struggling with issues in my life, or if I were any character in ancient literature struggling with it that we see, that's what I would experience. I would look like that from the inside. We have this semantic discursive character. It is sustained by speaking. It is trivial by comparison. We talked about how the nations are but dust in his hands, and the dust on the scales, how they would weigh things, and dust. And the dust was so trivial, you didn't even blow it off. It didn't contribute any weight. It was just trivial when compared to God in his immensity. But it was at the same time a delight to him. It was a thing of beauty. We talked about it being a gift to the Son, that it was created as a present to Jesus Christ. It was also designed for us to be amazed at. It was like the way you would create a craft for your kid, or a present for a friend, or a gift for a spouse, something that was meant to be delighted in by us. We looked at the fact that it was orderly, that there were rules that had a predictability about it, so that when we woke up every day, we didn't have to reinvent, we didn't have to relearn all of reality. If I had to learn how to tie my shoes every single morning, life would be very, very difficult. Okay? And there's a predictability, there's an orderliness about it. It's still open. We can change it. It can be changed. There are such things as miracles, and people do tend to change the universe on occasion as well. It is at the same time finite, temporary, and troubled. In other words, it is not as it should be. Things run down. We have this thing called the second law of thermodynamics, that maybe it was there at the creation, but it certainly accelerated after the fall. Let's put it this way. Things run down. I gave the example of house dust from my personal experience. It doesn't matter what I do. There's dust everywhere at the end of every couple of days. Things run down. Friction occurs. Some of that's important for us to be able to walk and things like that, but the level that we've got is sort of inordinate. We don't need quite that much, and we'd like to see that released, and we talked about that. We talked about that only part of the universe was visible to us. It's almost like we've got a filter on. We can't see it all. We see a good bit of it. We see enough to get the work done. We're given what's required. We're given the appropriate tool sets to be nice to other people. Okay. We're given sort of what we need. There's a lot that we don't have, And we'll talk a little bit when we get into humanity about science and the arts and engineering, what those functions are relative to that. We talked about that everything was interconnected, okay? That everything impacts everything else. We gave the example of a tennis ball. If I could create a tennis ball by speaking right here, instantaneously there would be gravitational attraction between that and every other known particle with mass in the universe, instantaneous. Okay? And we talked about everything is tied together. And I wanted to mention that it's not like the Star Wars Force kind of thing. Remember, there was the Force that held all the universe, you know. And somebody's mentioned that that kind of force is more like duct tape. It has a light side, a dark side, and it holds the universe together. Okay? And we're talking about something a little more intrinsic in the very fact of existence and creation. It's interconnected and all impacts all, for good or ill. A single act of kindness that I might do may ripple throughout all eternity, just as a single word of abuse will do the same effect. Okay? Huge leverage, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get into humanity. We talked about fixed laws, and we talked about the fact that we were agents out here, that we have the ability to change things. We actually can have an impact on this universe for good or ill, the same way we have an impact on people for good or ill. Part of the ecological discussions, you know, that are currently, a hot issue for us have to do with the fact that how seriously have we taken our responsibility in some areas, okay? We'll talk that when we get to the cultural mandate as well. And the last point we made before the intervening weeks was that the universe was inhabited by other centers of awareness, which meant other intelligences. We talked about God as one that plays in the universe. We talked about angels are here. Those are disembodied intelligences. They're not embodied intelligence. They have some kind of spatial location. They travel from place to place, but they don't seem to have the strong material boundaries that we do. We don't know a lot about that. And then there are other people, and then we talked about animals, that the higher animals are, to use Martin Buber's phrase, on the threshold of personhood. So puppies are playful, and cats are arrogant toward us. So they have these characteristics that are on the threshold of personhood, if you will. A cat can literally do damage to your self-esteem by the way they look at you, okay? And a good old faithful mutt can make you feel superior in those moments when you need to recover from that other experience. We'll talk more about those species when we get into humanity as well. But there are other centers of intelligence and other agents in this universe other than us. And now we move to new material. So we're now on page 6 of that syllabus. Under topic M, called the universe being teeming with life, that the universe was not made just like a stage where there are no actors, but it is literally teeming with life. It's not just we have occasionally live people. It is just bursting. We have 4 billion humans. We have 4 billion chickens in the world. Okay? We have 4 billion chickens in the world. Okay? Yes.
Cynthia can hand out. We have a few extra copies left over. Just raise your hand if you want it.
Yeah, what they passed out was the one that we hope to get to today. Yes. So this is the one that, like I say, for those of you, this is a real test of memory, self-discipline. This was one we handed out 2 years ago and told you to bring it back. But I'm going to go ahead and start through the material there as we go. And we want to talk just briefly about what life is. So the first point there, and we're going to start with scriptural basis. Life has a vagueness about it. There are a couple of passages we want to look at first. First one is life is in the blood. And this is a Leviticus passage because the life of every creature is in its blood. Okay? The life is somehow in the blood. But on the other hand, you also have a passage that talks about the breath of life. So the passage reads like this, and I have to use my bionic technological assist here. And to all the beasts of the earth, and to all the birds of the air, and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. That's Genesis. Next verse, the Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. Wasn't a living being before the breath of life goes in there. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. This is Ezekiel's vision of the dry bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. All right? So there's two things so far associated with the life. One is blood, and one is breathing so far. Okay. Now, the third point is that in a strict sense, a biblical sense, plants are not considered as alive in this sense of the word. We'll talk about how, in what sense they are alive in a minute. But in the sense of having a breath, the spiration they don't. So the passage there is, woe to him who says to wood, come to life, or to lifeless stone, wake up, can it give guidance? This is, of course, about idols. I mean, this is not just rock itself, but a rock that's carved out of an idol. It says, come to life. That's the man trying to create God model, which we do generally a couple times a week. It is covered with gold and silver. There is no breath in it. Okay? So plants are generally pictured in the scriptures as a food source. Okay? They're generally a food source, as you can see for this. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it, they will be yours for food. Okay? And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds of the air, and all the creatures that move upon the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And Genesis, another passage says, he makes grass grow for the cattle, and plants for man to cultivate. See the picture? These are instruments for us. They're food sources, okay? And they're a little bit broader than food, bringing forth food from the earth. Wine that gladdens the heart of man, so that's some enjoyment. Oil to make his face shine, and that's both cosmetics as well as medicinal uses of herbs. And bread that sustains his heart, the basic food. So the plants are generally pictured in one sense in the Bible, as not being alive per se, so that when you eat a piece of broccoli, you are not committing murder. Okay, just let's get that straight. Even if it's previously dead, it doesn't apply in those Levitical laws that said you can't eat the carcasses of animals on the roadside, so you're still okay there. It has a different kind of, we'll talk about reproduction in just a minute. But what the implication for us in this particular study is that life is somehow connected to respiration, breathing, and combustion, burning food. Okay? And the way I've understood this is the energy intake system that allows us to outrun the second law of thermodynamics. So if you think about it, this shouldn't work. Me standing up here, I'm worth about 53 cents worth of chemicals. A little less, I've lost weight recently. Okay? About 53 cents worth of chemicals on today's open market. Now, theoretically, the second law of thermodynamics said I shouldn't have lasted this long. I should have eroded much faster than I am eroding. Okay? It should have been gone very early. Okay? The problem is that I keep changing it. Just when it catches up and I get tired and start to run down, guess what? I eat a Twinkie. Right? I do something. And I inject something new into the system, and I outrun the second law of thermodynamics, the running down. See, I just stay ahead of it for a long period of time until some internal clocks go off. Okay? And that's apparently what life is. It's something that builds, contains the organization, contains the unity of the self, and outruns the second law of thermodynamics. So we can literally change the mix because we have a head start on the rest of the universe. See? So life apparently is this ability to outrun decay in itself, okay, and go back to the normal decay mechanisms and fix it too. I can literally go plant a garden. I can make a field and grow wheat and feed folks. See what I'm saying? So we can inject life as a source of creativity and integration and health back when it's done right. So apparently that's what the motif, but I have to consume stuff in this process, and part of that's what the plants are. Now, point four about life was self-identity and self-directedness. And I give an example here of one of my favorite pets, Paramecium, a little single-celled organism that you can't see. They don't get in the way. You don't have to clean up after them. That's why I keep them as pets around my house. Paramecia, and this is a quote from a consciousness studies technical journal. Paramecia, for example, can apparently learn, remember, and exhibit adaptive responses such as avoidance and habituation, which involve movement performed by coordinated actions, metachronal waves, of hundreds of hair-like appendages called cilia. Now, if you remember what this looked like, it's just this one blob, and they've got all these hairs along, like a bristle brush around the ends. And they swim with these things, right? And so they'll come up and they'll hit a wall, and they'll use and reverse swimming. They'll back up, and they'll veer off about 15 degrees, and they'll swim in this direction, right? And if they ever get back to the spot where they started, they won't go hit the same wall again. Even a monkey learns to duck. Okay? Promethium learns faster than we do. They don't do this very often, and they will veer off. Now, they're a single cell. They don't have a thing called a neural synaptic gap. They don't have a single brain cell. All they are is a cell. But they are alive. They are adaptive. They learn. We don't know whether they have positive memories of these experiences of hitting walls or not. But the point is that life form has this ability to grow and adapt and change and interact and respond and all these kinds of weird things that we do up a little bigger. See? Life has a self-identity. It knows who it is and where it's going. It knows some things about itself. It identifies itself as a unity. It can tell the difference between it and other. See, I know that I am not the same as this thing if I bump into this. I can detect where my boundaries end and where this thing starts. See, life can do that. A rock can't. A rock cannot tell the difference of the boundaries. See what I'm saying? Life has a sense of identity somehow. Somehow it has a sense of identity. Okay? Point five is that life is driven, literally driven, to replicate itself. When God said, in a very loud voice apparently, be fruitful and multiply according to their kind, he started an explosion of reproduction that nobody ever stops. This thing just goes on and on. You take a single cell, guess what it does? Splits into two, right? And guess what those do? They split into two, et cetera, right? In other words, we are literally built somehow to just spring forth and fulfill this command, be fruitful and multiply. Boom. Remember, the pagan gods did not like this back in the old days. We'll see a little bit later, perhaps, that maybe we'll get a chance to study that, actually, about how a lot of Genesis, the first nine chapters of Genesis, were written as Moses was about to enter the land. And the Israelites, he knows he's not going over there to beat these people up about the head and neck. So he's going to have to give them some tools for dealing with the Canaanites. Well, the Canaanites have a Bible back in those days. And they had a Bible that looked a lot like Genesis 1 through 9. So their early traditions had things like the flood tradition. But the reason God sent a flood to them was that the people were too noisy. That the human race had populated too much instead of be fruitful and multiply. But people were bad. They were too noisy and the gods could not sleep. So they decided to kill us. Tried three times, finally got around to drowning us. Okay? And so it had a devaluation of human life. And so Moses said, now what's the best way to make sure that these folk, when they run across their Bible, something gets triggered? Well, I'll make a Bible that looks like that, but I'll change the content to where it shocks them. So when it says over in the Canaanite Bible, and all of the stars are gods too, he said, well, I'll make a little subtle put down, and in Genesis 1, I'll just put the stars in as a footnote. God created the big lights and the little lights, and oh, and he made the stars also. I'll just sort of trivialize it because it ain't true. And so when they read this, they'll think, oh, I remember something Moses wrote. Oh, maybe these really aren't gods, and I shouldn't bow down and sacrifice my children to these things because they don't like people. See? So there was a clash here, and so a lot of what we've got there, like I say, was an incredibly clever teaching device that God gave that said, do it this way, because when these folks run across these people, we're going to need some kind of triggering memory mechanism so they'll respond at least as cleverly as Promethea. So life is driven to replicate itself. And the interesting thing about this is that we have a history. Okay, we have a creator status, almost. When you look at the universe, we'll come back to this in just a minute, about the universe tells us something about God. And one of the things, when you look at life, if it is always busy creating something like itself, see, there's a lesson in there about what God is like. See, we were made in the image and likeness of God. The heavens declare the glory, which is the essence of God. Okay? There's something about the way life just explodes all the time. It's always creating. It's always creating. It's always busy replicating. It's always trying to make more robustness, more variety, and things of this type. And it tells us something about God's intent. He wants us to be fruitful and multiply. Not just quantitatively, but qualitatively. He wants me to be more Glenn tomorrow than I am today. One of the fruits of the Spirit is called self-control. He wants me, one thing, to be more in control of myself tomorrow than I am today. In other words, he's trying to produce a robustness in us. Instead of making us all alike, he wants us to be all more and more different. And there's a strangeness about this. There's a cynic, I think his name is Stephen Wright, one-liner king, and he's got a statement that says, remember, you are completely unique as an individual, like everybody else in the world. Right? And there's some truth to that, the fact that we were created to be different. Like everybody, he wants that level of robustness and variety in the universe. And I remember in the early days as a Christian, I tried so hard to be like a couple of folk. And God had to just sit there and just beat me up. Said, no. Every time you look more and more like this person, more and more like that person, I'm not going to bless. I'll take my hands off of the drill. I'll let you do that, let you reap the consequences, kind of thing. But I want you to be who you are. I built you this way. I want you to reproduce after your kind. Your kind, okay? So in this kind of model, life has an identity, and it's driven to constantly reproduce. And it has a history. It has a history. I am connected to my father and mother and their parents, and I'm connected down the chain. I'm also connected laterally. I have people that I talk with, that I have known through history. When I was away in these intervening weeks, I met somebody that I had not seen in 22 years. He was my closest friend for a year in Florida. And you instantly took up the friendship from the point it left off. Instantly. There's history. We have the ability to do these things. It's an incredible thing because we're built this way. We're actually built with eternity in our hearts. And the last point under teeming with life is that all of this life and all this explosive variety and its creative urges and drives is still dependent upon God. We are dependent for every breath still on this master. And the example that the psalmist gives here, I've always thought about. The lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. There the ships go to and fro, and the Leviathan, which you form to frolic there. These all look to you to give them their food at the proper time. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are satisfied with good things. When you hide your face, they are terrified. When you take away their breath, they die and return to the dust. When you send your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. Okay? We are still, and every life form is still dependent upon God's provision, His care, His decision. Remember, He spoke us into existence. He contains us He sustains us by that same speaking, and He can just issue any kind of command. And we don't know how this works. We don't know how His language interfaces with reality. It doesn't make a lot of difference what the mechanics are. If He withholds their breath, they die. If He sends His Spirit to create them, they come back to life. They come to life. So there's an element here of dependence, and we have to recognize that we take literally every breath. We is dependent upon God. Every breath, every heartbeat, our composition as individuals, our growth, everything is still dependent. I mean, there are in moments of self-madeness, we'll get into thinking, yep, I made myself. God didn't help me at all. Right. So all you have to do is just take your normal heartbeat, multiply it times the number of years you've been alive, okay, and then you write a thanks for every one of those. And then once you finish that list, then you can get on to feeling proud about yourself. Of course, by that time, you've had more heartbeats, so you just got to keep track of this on short order. So it's a little tricky. We do have a dependence level. It's not something we have to be hyper about, though. There's an abandonment in trust of God. Where you say, Lord, I'm not gonna say I trust you, I trust you, I trust you, I trust you, I trust you every second, every millisecond. It's not this when you get up in the morning and say, here's another day, Lord, I'm counting heavy on you. You don't get it done, it doesn't get done. Should I move on to obedience now? In other words, there's a time at which you stop that and you charge ahead in the life where he says, I want you to actually walk humbly before me instead of just pray. Okay, I want you to get up, get moving, get moving. Some of you will have had those experiences where God has said no to a protracted quiet time. They don't come very often because we normally short God in the other direction. But there are times where we wanted to pray 4 hours instead of going to the exam. You're supposed to take. Okay. And there are times that he'll say, sorry, click, click. We'll dry that up real quick. Let's move ahead. Let's move on to obedience. So the universe is teeming with life. There are lessons here of beautiful stuff. We will talk when we get to the bus stop on our history on why some of these life forms are different than they probably were when they were created. We will talk about viruses. Okay? We will talk about predators. We will talk about some of the changes that have occurred in the history of the world since it was originally created and God said it was all good. So our next section is called Given Over to Us. And this is probably the first piece of bad news we've heard so far. This is that this created universe is given over to us to sort of be stewards and servants of and caretakers of. We're supposed to take care of this universe. And the verses, Psalm 115 says, the highest heavens belong to the Lord, but the earth he has given to mankind. And so the authority over this he's fairly given to us. And even when God meddles in human history, so to speak, he still transfers control from one human to another. So the passage he gives here, he's about to judge Israel rather seriously. Give them a message for their masters and say, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Tell this to your masters. With my great power and outstretched arm, I made the earth and its people and the animals that are on it, and I give it to anyone I please. Sovereign. Now I will hand all your countries over to my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. I will make even the wild animals subject to him. All nations will serve him and his son and his grandson until the time for his land comes. Then many nations and great kings will subjugate him. In other words, God has said, this is all in control. You're not doing a good job with it. I'm going to take it from you and give it to somebody else. And I'm going to accomplish my will in here, and eventually they're going to mess up to the point where I can't in good conscience do that either. And so I'll take it from him as well. Okay. In other words, we have responsibility for doing what's right, so God doesn't have to come in and do these ad hoc kinds of things. See, there's a general principle here that we're supposed to be doing things right so that you don't have to have exceptions to the law. You don't have to have aberrant processes, we would call in the business world. Okay. Things are supposed to work according to this order of love and kindness and gentleness and care for one another that we see a lot more in humanity. But the universe literally is given over to us, and we can mess it up, or we can optimize it. There are some incredible things we can do with resources once you give it to us. Power is a wonderful thing if you are a wonderful person. Power is a wonderful thing if you are a wonderful person. That's what it's for. Leverage. To get resources and pour that out, look at Jesus Christ. All the power in the universe, the qualities, excellence, he spent it wisely, so to speak. Right? He gave his life to redeem the entire universe. Act of love, glorified the Father, sent the Spirit. Incredible, incredible leverage. Okay? Holy Spirit's given to the New Testament church. Incredible leverage. We have this book. We have this book. Incredible leverage. And the thing is, we need to take advantage of the resources that we're given for good. For good. We can either squander it, we can misuse it, things of this type, but we have a tremendous power to do something positive here. A simple prayer, nobody notices the prayer, bends the ear of the God of the universe. I mean, there's not any higher leverage that you can imagine. You could do anything else in the world and not achieve the same outcome as invoking God on your side, God to do something. Calling upon his name and saying, would you break in here and do something? We need some help here. We need some ad hoc work. Okay? Tremendous leverage. Whether we take advantage of that's a different issue altogether. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground. There was a command to subdue the earth. There was a command to rule it. Okay? It was not to be despotic, but it was to take the garden and get rid of the weeds. It was to make it orderly, to grow it into something, subdue it, put it into the harness for the glory of God and for the achievement of His will, which is an expression of love among us. Okay? There were things that we were supposed to do. We were commanded to do this. This was an order. But, as you, for those of you that have seen, the next line says, but why do we blame shift? God gives us the universe. We're supposed to be taking care of one another. We're supposed to be doing good things. But every time we foul it up, we will blame Him. So, one of the most amazing verses to me is Proverbs 19:3. A man's own folly ruins his life, yet his heart rages against the Lord. Right? We get mad at God when we foul things up. Okay? Distressed and hungry, they will roam through the land. But these are people that are out of the will of God so far. They're starting to, like, say, do child sacrifice and things of this type. Distressed and hungry, and God's trying to get them to pay attention by discipline. Distressed and hungry, they will roam through the land. When they are famished, they will come enraged, and looking upward will curse their king and their God. You know, they make their own bed. They're supposed to lie in it, but when they do, they complain about the innkeeper. Okay? They complain. Right? And don't forget the paradigm case of blame shifting, Genesis 3. Remember, that's the first one. This is where we learn this process. Remember, you got the serpent, story of the serpent, the woman, and the man. And when God goes to the man and says, why did you do this thing? He points his finger at who? The woman. Says, the woman you gave me, not the woman I have. Okay? I mean, not even a neutral statement. The woman you gave me, emphatic. The woman you gave me the fruit. Right. So he logically goes to the woman and says, what is this that you've done? And who did she point to? Serpent. The serpent tricked me, and I ate. So he starts at the serpent, okay, but works up to everybody shares in the guilt of that one. Because everybody gets a little something out of that corrective action. Okay? But we do this as a matter of course. Remember, I often use the example that I've given here a number of times about that. Remember that fifth grader with the all Fs on the report card? Remember, he goes into the dad in the cartoon, the dad's in the sofa, on the easy chair, rather. He goes in and hands his dad the all Fs on the report card, and the dad looks forlorn, and the son says to the father, well, Dad, what do you think it was, environment or heredity? Right? Right? Okay. And what's happened is we've shifted blame through causal nexus, so to speak, to anything we can. We just will not accept responsibility for this. We'll talk a little bit about how we can't avoid the responsibility before God when we get into humanity. But that the universe literally is somehow turned over to us. We do have a tremendous accountability and a tremendous power to do something with these things. We literally have, we each have our own little universe, so to speak, of our control. So you have a universe up here where you can create all kinds of stuff that you can sort of test pilot, if you will. You can test it up here. Do the thought experiments. You can design your little world, your ideal house, and your ideal life, and things of this type. We can also do the wrong things in the thought life as well. We can create alternate realities that are not positive as well. That's a huge problem that we generally have as human beings. But you can create something, and then by speaking, you can bring it out into reality. Or by doing, you make it out here. See, in here, I can always change it. Click, click. All it changes is me. That's the reason you don't want to think negative thoughts or bad things or destructive patterns in your life for very long, because it does affect your brain function. It actually, everything you do affects a piece of reality. Spiritual choice will affect you somehow. If you stay after stress, for example, what does that do to your body? It suppresses the immune system, and in my case, I get a cold. I get a cold routinely. It reminds me to lighten up. To lighten up, trust God, and walk with Him. And so, in this kind of model, everything you do shows up in reality. Okay? Everything you do in the thought life will affect just you. But as soon as you speak it, well, it's now between friends or between the loved ones or between associates or something of this type. You can't get it back. You can't get it back. It has a tremendous power. Once it gets out there, it becomes an object, and it starts doing its own thing. it starts affecting all of other things. Okay? When I do something, it has the same kind of consequences. Tremendous power. A word spoken in season to him who is weary. Tremendous power. Tremendous power. A smile. You never know, but you can't ever take it back. You can't take a smile back. Now, let me caution you about this. When I talk about the awesomeness of the leverage, if you have a background like I do as a 4-plus obsessive compulsive, that can scare you tremendously. I remember literally 25 years ago writing in my notebook, my actions have eternal consequences. And so that paralyzed me. Right? Because I thought, oh my gosh, blue socks or green? Which one? Because this is eternity we're talking about here. It's going to ripple down. I don't know whether somebody's going to break out in hives to my green socks. You know, or turn off. You know, but then we have this verse that says, love covers a multitude of sins. So much depends upon the spirit that you do so many of these smaller decisions in. And so in a life of faith, you get up and you say, I trust you, God, let's go. You launch. Boom. You go. You keep your heart clear, your conscience clean, you stay in this book and say, I don't know what I'm supposed to think. Do this. Change me. I don't know what I'm supposed to be studying about the Levitical law this morning. I'm working on a project on cost recovery in the business. Why am I looking about the cost of sacrifices? Is this an indication that I should do layoffs? No. But you get the drill. I don't know what it's for, but all I know is it goes inside and changes me from the inside out. It changes me from the inside out. So the thing is, you don't want to get too hyper about this. You want to take advantage of it joyfully, right? But remember that the thing you want to prioritize is the love category. The humility category, the servant heart, because you want to be like God. Okay? So, the blame shifting. Now, the last point under this before we get into humanity is that the universe tells us something about God. Now, a lot of what we've already talked about, we've talked about how it mirrors something about God. We can see things about God in this. And a couple of verses, and I'm talking specifically about God's variety. His sensuality, the musicality. And we talked about perhaps this was either a poem that he used to create the universe or a song that he used to create the universe because of the mathematical elegance and things of his type. And there are a couple of verses that we talked about here about this robustness, the variety. There are also heavenly bodies and there are earthly bodies, but the splendor of the heavenly bodies is of one kind and the splendor of the earthly bodies is another. The sun has one kind of splendor, the moon another, and the star is another, and star differs from star in splendor. Point being is that there are a number of things that God created, and they're all wondrous things, but they're all different. They're wonderful in a different way. And so out of the people here in this audience here, right, everybody is different. Okay? You all have your own individual splendor and glory, okay? And it's still a very real glory, even though it may not be like anybody else's. It is still that level of individuality. Next verse was, thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. See, a lot of the design in the universe is serious overkill. We don't need tens of thousands of species of wildflowers. We really don't need this in a strict sense of the word. It is not intensively important to my survival. The domesticated ones I plant die. Okay. I can't do 3 or 4 species. 10,000, fortunately, they're wildfires, so they can survive Glenn. But I only drive by them and look at them. I don't have responsibility for them. But the universe was created in all its vast array. There's something about God that tells you. There are different kinds of gifts. Now he's talking about the gifts in the body of Christ. There are different kinds of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are different kinds of service, but the same Lord. There are different kinds of working, but the same God works all of them in all men. In other words, didn't make us all a foot, or a hand, or a toe, or an earlobe. Okay? He made us all different. We all have different gifts because he likes this, because it's variety. Remember, he's a Trinity. Tremendous variety in a Trinity. Lots of it. Lots of interactions that we're going to mirror ourselves as well. The heavens declare the glory of God. Famous passage, Psalm 19. Okay, now, the glory generally means different things in different passages as mean, but in this particular passage, it generally talks about the plenitude of God, the the effulgence, intensity of his character, if you will. Remember, the glory shined. It made Moses' face shine. They were afraid to look at it because they were afraid it was going to kill them. It's this brightness, the consuming fire, the burning bush. This is the glory of God, the intensity of his character, the outwardness of his character. It manifests itself. And so the heavens declare an aspect of his character, this variety, this teeming with life, this ceaseless activity that is the universe. The scholastics, the St. Thomas Aquinas genre of scholastics, in their towers they would be writing and they were studying, and they had a term that they used philosophically for God, actus purus. God was pure act, ceaseless motion, nothing stopped at all, constantly doing, ceaseless activity. Okay? We in Western civilization, we have a staid God. We have a quiet, he's not active, he's passive, we have to pray to get him active. No, he's constantly working. Jesus Christ, right now, to believers, for those of you that know him and walk with him, is doing everything possible from a divine standpoint in your life as we speak to build you in the image of Christ and make you happy. Everything that's required in terms of character, providence, etc., is being done right as we speak. When you drive home, the same thing applies. Ceaseless activity. Okay? He doesn't get tired, so he doesn't force a Sabbath on himself. But he wants us to rest in this process, but it's ceaseless activity. There's something about God that tells us. The heavens declare this intensity of God. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. When we see, when we look out, somehow, we see that God is powerful. We see that God has power, that it's eternal. There's a stability about the universe. We are generally dwarfed by it. We don't know what to make of the universe. We come up with little theories about where it came from, but we get stuck right there. We can't get any bigger than that. And his divine nature, that's a special word that sort of has to do with the fact that he is divine, that he is bigger than us. Let's put it this way. If the word, it was literally called Godhead. It literally, just the deity of God, just his absoluteness. Doesn't tell says that there's something out there over against us that we are involved in whether we like it or not. We're involved with whether we like it or not. Okay, so the universe tells us something. And the last little section I have that we read at the beginning of the previous section, for those that were here 10 years ago, I talked about unnecessary variety. And I'm going to read these, and I want you to feel these if you can, because there's a sensuality in nature that God built in that is unnecessary unless you're our kind of God, unless you're the kind of God we're talking about here. And just feel these or smell these or tactically engage with, tactfully engage with these. Cinnamon. Scarlet. A gentle breeze. An unfolding sunset. The feel of cool water. The sound of a harp. The warmth from a fire. The tang of mustard. The loyalty of a pet, the smell of fresh clover, the looks of lovers, honeysuckle, either the taste or the smell, the smile of an infant, of a baby, the sound of a gentle rain on a hot summer day, red ringlet hair, the clarity of the stars, the brooding of the ocean,